Okay, so you know I love good wordplay. And Third Love is crushing their wordplay here. When you have a bra that pinches or slips or just isn't comfortable at all, or is comfortable but isn't your style, you've got problems. How excited was Third Love when they thought of problems? Well done, Third Love. I see you. When you wear Third Love bras, you've got no problems. They fix the problem of size exclusivity with their famous half-cup sizes that revolutionized the industry by giving more options to find a bra that fits. And they fixed the problem of guessing what bra will fit you with their virtual fitting room and other helpful guides. A bra size chart, a bra 101 education section that's basically an FAQ for all your burning questions, and a ton of great reviews from real people. My sister just texted me 99 problems, but pinching isn't one. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with code PODCAST15. So welcome back to We Can Do Hard Things. We are with actual sex queen, Emily Nagoski, who I'm going to read her actual. I got so excited during the first episode with Emily that I did not read her official bio. So I'm going to read it right now. Emily Nagoski is the award-winning author of the New York Times bestselling Come As You Are, newly revised and updated in 2021. And the Come As You Are workbook, and the co-author with her sister Amelia of New York Times bestseller Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. By the way, I want to say, Emily, that I did not know you wrote that freaking book, and I read it twice last year. I didn't know that wrote it, and with your sister. It's so good. You all need to get Burnout.
I love that we both work with our sisters.
I know. Another connection, the Silent Sex Queen sister. She earned an MS in counseling and a PhD in health behavior, both from Indiana University and clinical and research training at the Kinsey Institute. And now she combines sex education and stress education. Amazing, that combo. To teach women to live with confidence and joy inside their bodies. She lives in Massachusetts with her two dogs, a cat and a cartoonist. Freaking, I even love your bio, Emily. Let's hear a question from our audience.
Let's do it. Okay. Our first question is a call-in from Wesley.
Hi, Glennon. Hi, sister. Hi, Abby. I don't know if you'll be on, but hi, you all. I love you guys. My name is Wesley, and my hard question today is how do you deal with navigating a relationship where you and your partner have different sex drives? I feel like mine is much higher than his, and like we've talked about it, we've tried to compromise, we've tried all sorts of things, but he still just doesn't seem to want to do it as much as I do. And this just causes my mind to jump to all sorts of conclusions and assumptions, like I'm not good enough, pretty enough. Maybe he is being satisfied by someone else and I don't trust him as much. And I don't like that. And I just could use some advice. Yeah. Love you guys. Bye.
Part of me, the pragmatic me, wants to dive in and give as much like here, concrete specific advice, tips and tricks to make sure people feel helped. But I think that's not like when you can hear the mm-hmm. sadness and loneliness. And I want to make sure we address that, recognize it, honor it for what it is. That when a partner declines sex routinely, the person who keeps trying to initiate is going to have feelings about that. And that's normal and healthy and fine. And the trick to moving forward is to get very concrete and specific with yourself so that you can bring that to your partner. So I would like Wesley to make a list on a sheet of paper, right at the top, what is it that I want when I want sex? And then on the back side of that paper, or maybe like draw a line down the middle of the paper and on the other side, write, what is it that I like when I like sex? Sex is doing a lot of work, or she would like it to be doing a lot of work. I don't know. I don't know their pronouns now that I mention it. They don't know how much weight sex is carrying. Because sex by itself is joy and pleasure and excellence, potentially, or it's just a fun hobby. But it can be a mode of deep emotional connection. It can be a path for self-discovery and mutual discovery. So which of those things is this caller looking for? Do they want to feel connected? And when their partner says no, they feel isolated and lonely? If that's the case, then find other ways to feel connected. Talk about, like, what are the things we do when I feel closest to you, when I feel like you are super there for me? I hear the trust issue also. Is he getting his needs satisfied somewhere else? Trust is the bedrock of relationships. And fortunately, there's a whole bunch of science about it. Sue Johnson, the therapist and researcher who developed emotionally focused therapy, which most of us will encounter as the Hold Me Tight workshops. She defines trust as the answer to the question, are you there for me? And R, of course, stands for emotionally accessible, emotionally responsive, and emotionally engaged. So that when I come to you with some difficult feelings, you turn toward them. You don't just keep watching your TV show and go, You turn toward the person and you listen with kindness and compassion. That is the most important resource we give and receive in relationships, is turning toward each other's difficult feelings. And this is a doozy of a difficult feeling. It is incredibly, it's like extra difficult, because you want to have this conversation in a way that avoids blaming or judging either person. It is a third thing. It is this tangled knot of stuff that you co-created. I use this very ridiculous metaphor of the sleepy hedgehog.
Yes, I love it.
Where, like, when you have a difficult feeling, imagine that it's like a sleepy hedgehog that's just like sitting in the bed when you want to get in the bed, and you've got to do something about it. So what, you can't yell at it. You can't just throw it against a wall. Somebody's going to get hurt if you do that. So what you do is you gently turn toward it. You find out its name. Its name in this case might be loneliness. It might be insecurity. It might be distrust. And then you ask it, what did it need in order to move out of your bed?
Oh my God.
And free itself. And when it tells you some things, you take it in your palms and you go to your partner and you say, hello, when you have a moment, I want to introduce you to loneliness, which is this difficult feeling I'm having. And when I think about it, what it needs is this. Do you think that might be something you can help me with? Boom. So that we can get this hedgehog out of our bed?
Oh my God.
These are not easy conversations. And I think a lot of, like, individual prep work is valuable. Getting really clear about what it is you want when you want sex, what it is you like when you like sex. And on the other side, especially if you're the lower desire partner, P.S. when couples seek therapy for differential desire, it's... in straight couples, it's just as likely to be the man who's lower desire as the woman. Also think about, what is it that I don't want when I don't want sex? Question for the lower desire partner. What is it that I don't like when I don't like sex? I'm going to channel the brilliant sex therapist and researcher Peggy Klein-Plotz, who would have, you know, couples come to her. They haven't had sex for years. And one of the partners will say, it would be fine with me if we never had sex again. I'm only here because my partner wants it. And Peggy's question is, tell me more about this sex you don't want. Mm. And sometimes it is dismal and disappointing sex. And here's Peggy's radical, radical idea. It is normal not to want sex you don't like. But also, maybe what you don't like is the feeling of obligation, of responsibility, of maybe you are so stressed, overwhelmed, and exhausted that you cannot find your way to the erotic place in your mind. And what you need is help getting to the erotic place, finding out which other places in your brain have a doorway into your erotic mind.
I love that. So does it mean you don't have the erotic place or you don't like eroticism? It means you can't, it's blocked. You can't get to it.
Some people have like teensy tiny little sort of like medicine cabinets of eroticism. Mm-hmm. Asexual folks, like there's just not a lot of it there. And fair enough, people vary. Some people have a palace of erotic mind place. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who basically, it's not just that every other mind state has a doorway into the lust area in his brain. It's that he's usually in the lust place and he can like go other places if he wants to. And cool, like people vary. Uh-huh. People yeah. just vary.
That was awesome.
Hungry Root's standard is simple but important. Step one, it's got to taste good. Step two, it's got to be quick to make. And step three, it's got to contain whole, trusted ingredients. And those three sound simple in theory, but when there's the option for takeout and there are stressful work days where meal prep isn't a priority, and when you've got picky eaters in the family, God help us, it's easier said than done. But Hungry Root makes it possible. We just built our first personalized cart after taking the fun little intro quiz, and soon my fridge will be filled with dairy-free snacks and drinks for John and the kids, prepared heat-and-eat meals for the whole family, and other high-quality groceries they're shipping over. I can't wait. Right now, Hungry Root is offering We Can Do Hard Things listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Did they say free veggies for life? Just go to hungryroot.com/hardthings to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/hardthings. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. All right, let's hear from Heather. Here's Heather. What do you do when you don't desire sex at all? I'm 44 and have been married to a wonderful man for 22 years. Sex has always been fine, but intermittent and sometimes conspicuously absent. I was raised in a Southern Baptist church, and scarring and shame you talked about it in your last episode is only too real, as I have yet to get over some of the lasting poison I drank for so long. Mm. Now I'm entering into what they say is perimenopause, which has brought with it what seems like a lack of desire for both of us. We haven't had sex in at least a year, maybe more. I've been thinking about what sex actually means to me. Such a good question. Never thought about it before. But now things with my husband feel super awkward and stagnant. Is this normal for women my age? Do you have any advice?
It's normal for people of all genders and of all ages. Let me first bust the myth that there's a relationship between the hormone changes of perimenopause and menopause and a shift in desire. When changes happen, it's maybe because people might be prone to pain because of vaginal atrophy from the change in hormones, but lube fixes that. Mm. And there's hormonal interventions that you can use if you're interested in having vaginal penetration. So it's not the perimenopause, except insofar as that's a psychological cue. But if two people spend a long time not having sex with each other, a lot of those hedgehogs can accumulate. There's just like dozens of them crawling all over the bed, snoozing, napping on each other. And you've got two tasks to manage. First, you have the task of gradually putting your bodies closer and closer to each other until you find your place, until you find yourself in a place where sex seems like a good idea. And that's like pretty pragmatic. That's like scheduling and like You can do if you Google Sensate Focus, Sensate, S-E-N-S-A-T-E, Focus, or graded exposure therapy, you give yourself steps to follow of like getting closer and closer to each other. That's one of the practical things to do. The other thing, which is a separate process, is dealing with all the feelings that everybody has about the problem. You have to address the feelings separately from the process of solving the problem that caused all the feelings, which the sleepy hedgehog metaphor can do. Sometimes you will find yourself getting closer and closer, and you're like reminded of that time when you really wanted to initiate, and the person turns you away, and like the way you felt shoved into a pit of despair, like this is never going to work. And you need your partner to listen kindly, generously, hold you in your arms, in their arms, and let you cry and have feelings and not take it personally, but do take it seriously. That's the two steps.
I like that.
Deal with the problem, but also manage all the feelings around the problem. And that's managing the feelings is the hard part. Mm-hmm. It helps if you can develop a shared vocabulary. For example, knowing about the brakes and the accelerator is very useful. What activates my accelerator? What activates my brakes? And also getting clear about the definitions of desire, arousal, pleasure, and consent. Because those are four different things that people mix up all the time. And so finding out what feels good is the first step. The reason I have people do what is it that I want when I want sex and what is it that I like when I like sex is that they are different things. One is what's the thing you're moving toward, and one is what is the thing you like in the here and now, in the moment when sex is happening. I also want to say that lots of people grow up in strong faith traditions where they are not taught that their bodies are bad and they don't have to hate themselves. In fact, their body is a gift from God and they are granted all of the pleasure that comes with it because God gave you this pleasure. Go for it.
What religion are we talking about?
I mean,
sign
like,
me up.
Branches of every religion, name a religion, and there are some people in that religion where the communities are like, yeah, we don't do that shame thing.
That's amazing.
So if you want to stay in a religion, find a different church or a different temple or a different mosque that doesn't teach that stuff.
We're going to hear from Melissa. Melissa says, I am a 45-year-old young woman that previously spent 17 years with my husband. 6 years ago, my husband became my wife. Life is moving along, and while I love my wife, I feel like a duck out of water. I had never been with a woman. We are slowly figuring things out, but I am exceedingly nervous about screwing something up. Pardon the pun. She's funny. I was always the receiver. I want that to be different. I guess my question is, how do I get past my fear of being the initiator? Oh.
You might know this because this is a little bit like your story.
I do know this one. But I want you to answer.
No, okay. I want you to answer. And then I will tell you. Just you go. I'm scared. I don't want to tell Melissa anything that's not, you know, scientifically correct.
So the science of it is actually pretty simple. There's a wonderful book called Magnificent Sex by Peggy Klein-Plotz, whom I just mentioned. She spent years interviewing people who self-identified as having extraordinary sex lives. And it included people of all genders, all sexual orientations, all relationship structures. And she found out that what extraordinary sex looks like has nothing to do with the standard cultural to narrative of sex. It's responsive desire. It's prioritizing sex, having sex mean enough in your relationship to be worth making time and space for. And the book goes through the science of why this is true and how to make it happen in your life. For me, this is a question about courage. It's a question about how to be brave. Mm-hmm. And like you have this break, it got trained into you when you were little child. And so it's not going to happen immediately all at once. You have to learn the thing step by step. You need your partner to be all the way there for you. When I was talking about trust and are you there for me, you know, you come into a room and you take off some clothes and this person is going to see parts of your body almost no one will see and touch parts of your body almost no one will touch. And maybe put a part of their body inside yours, or you're going to put a part of your body somewhere inside of their body. So if you show up with your body and their response is, meh, that is not a partner who is there for you. Mm-hmm. Or if they just take it for granted, like, good, your body's here. I've been waiting. You owe me. Right? That's a partner who's not there. So what you want is a partner who, when you show up, goes, yay, and wow, and thanks. Mm-hmm. Those are the signs that your partner is fully there for you. So if you and your wife, congratulations, are both thoroughly there for each other. What Peggy Kleinplot says is that great sex is sex that is just safe enough. So that you can
Abby pull, just like, fell out of her chair.
You explore your sexual terrain and you know what's true. But when it gets extraordinary is when you take a risk, like initiating, where you take hands with your partner. And like you've explored your sexual terrain, you know what's true, you love what's true, and together you take a step into the darkness of what you don't know.
Yeah.
That is where the magnificence happens.
Oh.
And that's true with everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, and then you have to be so vulnerable when you try something brand new that you've never done before. I mean, the first time I tried to be like the one to like make out with you, Abby, oh my God, I was so scared. I swear, I was like about to pee my pants. I was so scared because I just had to like, and then I did it though, because, you know, SSQ. But
silent sex queen.
But Emily, I also feel like I still, now we're 5 years in and I still feel scared. It's not like you do it once and then I'm scared and it all activates every single time. Mm-hmm. But you're
what
right.
What counts as safe enough is going to change from context to context.
Yes.
As the trust builds in a relationship, more stuff becomes safe enough.
Mm-hmm.
But trust between the two people is one thing. Trust of yourself is another thing. And the two don't necessarily grow at the same rate.
That's good.
And I, it's also true, isn't the trust and are you there for me, that extends beyond your sexual encounter, right? Like,
oh yeah,
it matters, are you
your
there for me all day long, not are you just doing the right thing right now, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I think sex, the way I define sex is throughout a day. It's like,
yeah.
That's the, like, the main element. It's like, are you actually here for me? Like, when you hand me that coffee, Glennon, I'm like, you are here for me, because you know how important that is.
So I talked about that with my therapist.
You talked about Abby's coffee with your therapist? This is
I talked
full
about
circle.
Like that I was gonna like come and do this, and I was talking about what your relationship looks like from the outside. And my therapist wrote her master's thesis on lesbian relationships and how they contrast to heterosexual relationships. She's a lesbian. And that dynamic of like, I am connected to you. And this is a way of knowing that is undervalued, because guess whose dominant style is likely to be connected knowing?
Mm-hmm.
It's women.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So lesbian relationships are sometimes characterized by more connected knowing than separate knowing. Less, the arguments are less based on fact and reason and more based on how it felt for me when you did this was like this, and how it felt for me. And I totally understand why I would feel that way for you. And what are we going to do? Because both of us are right.
So like, lesbian relationships are total immersion programs and heterosexual relationships are like Spanish 101.
If you want to learn something new, would you rather learn it on your own, from a random teacher, or from folks who are the best of the best in that skill? I think I know which option most of you would choose. That's made possible by MasterClass. In recent months, they've added classes from the likes of Ava DuVernay, who gives us tips on how to reframe our thinking in all walks of life, One of our personal favorites recently was the one-on-one time we got with Amy Poehler in her class on preparing to be unprepared. So good. With Ava DuVernay. With over 180 world-class instructors and a 30-day money-back guarantee for new members, there's no reason not to get started today. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/hardthings. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/hardthings. masterclass.com/hardthings.
Can you play the next voicemail, please?
Hi, Glennon and sister. I grew up in a family where abstinence is what was promoted, and it was kind of fear-based abstinence. If you're not abstinent, you'll get pregnant, you'll get an STD. And it worked for a while until I went to college. And then I think I rebelled against the taboo that had been created. So, you know, sex was shameful and there was a taboo about it. And now that I'm a mother and I have a young son, I don't want the pendulum to swing all the way in one direction of abstinent, don't ever do this, be ashamed of your body, nor do I want him to make choices on the other end of the pendulum to swing the other way, where decisions are all not made with love for his own body. So how do you talk to sex about sex with your children? How do you teach them that it's natural and normal and loving and respectful, but also protect them so they make decisions that keep their body safe? All right. Thanks, Glennon. Thanks, sister. Thanks, Abby.
Oh, I love this question so much.
I know, and
me
I love
too.
Her.
Retweet, because I have the same question.
I don't know anything about, like, age-appropriate conversation with kids. I have always taught college age and older. Like, give me a group of senior citizens and I know how to talk, but I don't know about age-appropriate answers to specific questions. So I can't give that information. May I recommend, though, any book by Corey Silverberg? He wrote the wonderful book, What Makes a Baby? Sex is a Funny Word. And he has a forthcoming book. I think it's called, you know, Sex.
That's good.
His books are great. Those are for younger kids, obviously. But what I can say instead of, like, what's age appropriate is the first step to take when you want to not pass on a bunch of junk that has messed with your sex life is to deal with your shit.
Mm. I was afraid you were going to say that,
damn
Emily.
It to hell, Emily.
Sorry.
But, like what's remember, another way?
So my mom, when she had that flash of emotion when I asked what a vagina was, mm-hmm. had no idea what she was passing on to me. It mm-hmm. wasn't on purpose. Mm-hmm. The most sex positive parents are the ones. So Peggy Orenstein writes about this mm-hmm. in her book, Girls and Sex, that it was only later in life that she recognized that when her mom, like, was explicit about sexual things and talked about sexual pleasure, and as a young person, a teenager, Peggy Orenstein was like, ugh, mom, don't, gross. It was only later that she came to appreciate just how powerful and important that was, that, like, be that parent who embarrasses your kids,
babe,
at the dinner table and in the car. Right?
Okay, like, yeah, because our kids do that. We're always bringing it up and they're always doing that drama. And when they do that, it makes me feel like we did something wrong, because why are they so, they're just appalled.
They're like,
yeah, because everywhere else they go is teaching them that, is the appropriate response.
Mm, okay.
Which is why she's talking about a pendulum swing. Mm-hmm. Abstinence is not the opposite of, like, not doing sex in a loving, respectful way. Mm-hmm. They are on the same side of the pendulum. For 40 plus years, the research has been utterly unambiguous that abstinence only, especially abstinence only until marriage education, increases rates of sexually transmitted infections, increases rates of unwanted pregnancies, and students have sex earlier. Earlier. It's called mm-hmm. sexual debut. It's another one of those terms I really like. Comprehensive evidence-based queer inclusive sex education, on the other hand, reduces rates of STIs, reduces rates of unwanted pregnancy, and increases age of first sex. It delays sexual debut, if that's a thing you're interested in. So comprehensive sex education gives you all the goals. You as a parent at home have the job of being the one who like is as undamaged by the cultural stuff as possible, or is sort of transparent, especially as they get to the teen years, transparent about like, yeah, the world's teaching you some bullshit nonsense. Don't believe it. Mm-hmm. And you're the inoculation against it. And you don't have to worry about going too far to the extreme. I have a sex educator friend with two daughters. And when they were really little, a common thing you would hear at their dinner table is, we don't touch our vulvas at the dinner table. Like, sex education includes boundary education.
Right.
Recognizing what's appropriate. Teaching people how to, like, read cues from other people.
Sister, talk about your...
Oh, God, I'm just so glad you said that, because sometimes I feel like I'm so on the opposite that, you know, like, my husband will say things like that, like, don't touch your privacy at the dinner table. And I'll be like, oh, my God, is she getting scorned? Like, you're trying to, like, put her in a box.
There are reasonable limits.
There are reasonable limits. That's so great to hear. Okay, so you can say... Don't touch your vulva.
Yeah, why isn't John saying vulva?
I'm trying to get him there. I'm trying to get... She knows it. She knows all.
She knows it.
Vulva all the time.
She knows. Sister is her mother. Your favorite word is vulva.
No, she knows all her parts. She knows her clitoris. She knows everything. But I didn't know... That's a good... Because they touch and I just never say anything, but saying we don't do that.
I mean, if you're at the mall... It feels good to touch your vulva.
Right. It does.
So, and if you're a little kid who hasn't, like, been taught that our culture has limits to where it's willing to grant you permission to touch your vulva, like, the mall is not one of them. Grocery store is not one of them. Mm-hmm. Your room? Go for
Perfect.
It. Yes. Shower? Go for it.
Great.
But Emily, I love the idea that so many of us are trying to figure out what do we say to our kids? And it's like, we're trying to figure out how to say the right thing without first becoming the right thing, right? Like, so we can, the first thing
you
she can do is
read
your
book. You don't have to
wait until you are perfect. No. If we do that, we're done. Yeah. Right.
Right.
But she can start detoxing herself.
Yes.
So that the things she say will naturally be less terrifying than the things she was taught. That's cool. Okay. Let's hear from Kat.
My stepdaughter came out last year. She's interested in girls, and her dad supports her, but her mom is very religious and seems to be discouraging her, saying she should wait until she's older to be sure. I don't know all the details, but I do know our house is more supportive, except we don't talk about it. And the other day, someone reminded me that my lens is entirely straight. From my experience, I know about romance between a man and a woman, and I know about sex with a man and a woman. If she has questions, I can do my best as a human who has been in love and lust and all sorts of messes. But what if that's not enough? Her father isn't worried about it, but I am. Does she need to talk to someone who has had the experiences she'll have? Does she need to read a book about two girls who fall in love or something I'm not even thinking of? How can I best support her being herself? I don't want to make y'all the poster women of lesbians, but the way you supported Chase when he came out, I want to throw a dance party too. And in lieu of that, I want to make sure I'm not just saying I support her, but I'm also giving her what she needs to thrive from her lens, not mine. Ugh.
Cat
for president.
Kat.
Love that. I love that the stepmom recognizes that she is not enough. I know it's sort of like we're all supposed to be like, I am enough. Nope. If you're 100% straight, you are not what a young person who's just coming out needs. That person deserves a community of peers and a community of elders to help learn. What's this all about? Otherwise, this kid has is scripts of heterosexuality. And so her experience with girls is going to be heteronormative. And that's not what we want.
Mm-mm.
So y'all feel free to dive in here. But my idea is books. Gift wrapped one by one in a huge basket. There are a couple of nonfiction books that are just necessary. One of them is Girl Sex 101 by Allison Moon. Don't know if you've read it, but it's the one, Girl Sex 101. And then there's a book called Queer, the Ultimate LGBTQ Guide for Teens by Kathy Belge. It was just revised in 2019. Things change really fast, so it had to be revised. So those are two sort of like encyclopedic, here you go. And just the fact that you're giving them is like, I went and got these. But there's also so many novels and so many comics. We don't know the kid's age. But again, anything by Corey Silverberg. There's Heather Corona of What Fresh Hell Is This? For ages 9 to 14, Heather and Isabella Rotman wrote a comic called Wait, What? That features an androgynous platypus that tells a story about sexuality and it's gender inclusive and sexual orientation inclusive and funny and charming. If she's a little bit older, like 14 and older, there's a great book called Let's Talk About It by Erica Moen and Matt Nolan. Erica Moen is the cartoonist who illustrated Come As You Are. And she and her husband wrote her own book about it for old. And again, it's entirely gender inclusive and entirely LGBTQIA plus inclusive. If this kid is up to a literary level where they're like reading for like big complex stories, Alison Bechdel's Fun Home. So good. Very specific. And the newest one on my list of the sort of graphic novels is Times I Knew I Was Gay by Eleanor Cruz, which is, again, for when you've got past 15 and you're reading in a deeper way.
Emily, one of the things I love so much about you, it's such a female leadership way of being, but I mean, you have just pointed out so many other resources for us. Every time you're so generous with your, I don't know, with the way that you've thrown light at so many different people, and you're just a huge source of goodness and depth. And I just have loved every minute of this. And I want to say to Kat, you know, when Chase came out, we are gay, all right? But we weren't enough. I mean, Abby and I had to look for people who come into your life now. It will just magically happen. It just magically happens. I mean, our kid has, he's gay and he's also Japanese. So he's, you know, got a bunch of intersections going on that we're not enough, right? So we had to find people that he could, we kind of were matchmakers, not in romantic relationships, but in like kind of can you be our kid's mentor? Can you be? Chase actually said to us once, I have enough moms. Mm. Like, I'm not sure I need more. And I'm like, yes, you do. Damn it. I know how many more you need.
Well, and if you don't have, if you don't have access to anybody, because I do also know that some people out there, they might know a gay kid, and they might be trying to find a community for them. There are so many different LGBTQ community-based chapters around the country, mm-hmm. even in very, very conservative places like Naples, Florida, where we just came from. They mm-hmm. opened one up while we were there. Take your kid there. Not only would it be an amazing resource for your kid, but it'll be an amazing resource for you, the parents, who also need to do a little bit of educating so that you can be the safe landing place for this gay kid. Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
And Emily, babe, I don't know what you'd say about this, but I feel like it's better to overdo it than underdo it.
Absolutely.
I mean, right? Like, talk about it more than what's comfortable to you, because this kid's going to be living in a world where so few things apply to them. Like, the more you can bring it up.
Ask yourself the question, if my child told me that it came out to me as straight, how often you would talk about said straight.
So did you meet a new kid?
Yes.
Did you have a new friend?
Exactly. And so if you find that there's a void in those same similar questions, just because your kid might have a tendency towards homosexuality or gayness or queerness, then you know that you have to sometimes overcompensate for your bias. Mm-hmm. And so that is where I think is important, that you give them as much space to talk about it, because then you'll be like me, where you have to come out 6 times. In 10 years. By the way, I'm still gay. By the way, Mom, I'm still gay.
IXL. Remember those three letters the next time your child asks you for help on homework. IXL Learning is an online learning community for kids that covers core subjects like math, science, and social studies in a helpful, feedback-driven way. So the fact that we cannot help our children with our homework now, which I actually cannot and stop being able to help them with after fourth grade, has been solved. IXL Learning's advanced algorithm is backed by research, and in studies done in nearly every state across the country, those who use IXL are consistently performing better in school. Plus, their subscription covers pre-K to 12th grade, and that wide range of ages and subjects is one of the many reasons why IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now, and We Can Do Hard Things listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/wecan. Visit IXL.com/wecan if you cannot help your child with their homework anymore. And there, get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. All right, listen, Emily, you're going to love this. This is, we do a pod squatter of the week. So this is an email I got, which just made me so happy. I'm going to change the names to protect the amazing. Okay. Dear Glennon and sister and Abby, thank you for being brave enough to record and share your Sex Queen podcast episodes. There was so much that I could relate to. Ended up discussing many of the topics with my husband, which was super helpful. So thanks. But my reason for writing is that I wanted to share a story with you. In your Q&A episode, there was much discussion about vibrators. And there was also a question about how to talk about, provide info to your kids about sex. So here's my story. Recently, I noticed that my vibrator was missing. This was a little alarming, as you can imagine. After a thorough search, I found it in my 15-year-old daughter's bedroom. Not knowing how to handle the situation, I took it back and we didn't discuss it. Not awesome parenting, I know. When it went missing a second time, I talked to my husband about this phenomenon and he said, just buy her one, which was great advice. So I did buy my 15-year-old child a vibrator. Yes, I did. But instead of giving it to her directly like a grown-up, I just put it in the hiding place where I had found mine. Soon thereafter, I walked into my kitchen to find my 15 and 18-year-old daughters looking at me with the vibrator smack in the center of the kitchen counter. This prompted a glorious discussion of vibrators, why we have them, sex in general, women as sex objects, porn, etc., etc. The next day, I bought one for my 18-year-old daughter, too. I hope this gives them freedom and removes some stigma about sex for them. Sister, I can't wait to share with them your 75% clitoral orgasm statistic. When the time is right, of course. Thanks for all you do, Melissa. Well, Melissa, they all have vibrators. I think the time is right now to teach them how to have an orgasm because now. Emily, yeah. Is that amazing?
That's amazing. That is amazing. That's amazing. Oh. And you know what? I am all in favor of the subtle, the quiet invitation of not being like, here is my gift to you. You can have a vibrator of your own. But just, you just leave it there where, you know, she goes looking so she can find it. And that is like a silent open door. And that you got away with not talking about the silence.
All right. What do you think about the silence? Do you want to save it for the next time? Because you know I'm going to harass you to come back here again. Or do you want, what do you think?
I want her to say the things about the silence.
I'm not going to go deep into the theory. I'm just going to go right into the psychoeducational intervention. Mm-hmm. You're going to draw a big plus sign on a piece of paper so that it's divided into four quadrants.
Okay.
In the first quadrant, you're going to write, what are the good things about silence? In the second quadrant, you're going to write, what are the not so good things about silence? In the third quadrant, you're going to write, what are the good things about noise? And in the fourth quadrant, what are the not so good things about noise? You're going to fill all of that out. You're going to look, like, what do I notice when I look at the good things and the not so good things about these two different things? Are there strategies I can use to maximize the good things and minimize the not so good things? Mm-hmm. On the flip side, I want you to write why it matters that you would try noise. And then I want you to write on a scale of 0 to 10, how important is it to you to make noise? And on a scale of 0 to 10, how confident do you feel that if you decided to try noise, you could, if you decided? Mm-hmm. That's the activity. And again, as the sister of professional musicians, as the daughter of a professional musician, my mom is a singer too. What I know is that the voice evolved to express emotion. That is its primary job. Oh. And I know a lot of us get raised to believe that women should be silent because our emotions are not welcome because we're human givers. Pretty happy, calm, generous, and attentive to the needs of others. God forbid we have experiences of our own. So it is part of your good things about making noise is that it's smashing the patriarchy with your voice.
Oh, plus, God. She got me again. She got me again.
Make your partner happy, yeah. too. If you can't get there, there are intermediate things. You can make tiny, tiny noises. Okay. You can just literally say the word moan.
Noise. Emoji. Smiley face emoji.
Oh my God, I'm just imagining that.
Moan.
That's such a writer thing too. She's going to literally say the word.
Or
and then she moaned.
What Abby said, what you did deserves a moan.
Yeah, what you did deserves a moan. Because Abby needs words of affirmation. Okay, babe, we're going to work on this. And I also like the assignment because I like any sex assignment that really only involves writing down words.
Also, you're perfect just the way you are.
Thank you. I love you. Emily, you are a hero for our times, a national treasure, what the world needs, the one we've been waiting for. We loved every minute of this. Please just go do all of your important work with freeing women to have more confident and joyful sex lives. And also come back and see us and also be our sister and also move next door to me.
Yes.
Okay.
All of those things.
Okay.
We love you so much.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you all for being at We Can Do Hard Things. If you get, scared, tired, exhausted, whatever this week, don't forget, we can do hard things. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you. This was so fun.
We Can Do Hard Things is produced in partnership with Cadence 13 Studios. Be sure to rate, review, and follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts. Especially be sure to rate and review the podcast if you really liked it. If you didn't, don't worry about it. It's fine.
I am an outdoors person. I'm a big fan of places that are rich in culture, history, and art. And most importantly, I'm a former resident of the great state of Oregon, which is why I want to tell you about Travel Oregon. When you find a guide through Travel Oregon, you'll be able to leave the planning to the local guides and experts, and this is a game changer. Instead of trying to find a good hiking trail and hope for the best, you can get a tour guide to bring you to the must-see spots, ensure you're provided with all the necessary safety gear, and show you all the amazing little nuggets you might miss on your own. And because the guides and tour companies are small businesses, they're led by incredibly passionate people. You can find experts who speak multiple languages and know about a variety of cuisines, or if you want a biking tour, you can find local guides to help you to customize your tour. There's so much to explore. Learn more at traveloregon.com.